Hi, everyone, and welcome back to The Nearness. I'm Casper, one of the co-founders, and it's my absolute pleasure to be stepping into something a little bit new with this episode. We're going to have a longer conversation with a guest to help us understand one of the core practices that we're exploring in this pathway, which is visualization. And so today we have Dr. Michael Motilla, who is a lecturer in religion at the College of Liberal Arts at the University of Massachusetts, Boston, joining us to share his expertise. Mike earned his PhD at Harvard University and studies late antiquity, mysticism, Christianity, and gender, sexuality, religion, and literature. It's a big pot of excitingness. He's the author of a book called Imitations of Infinity, which is based on his PhD thesis, Gregory of Nyssa and the Transformation of Mimesis. I don't know what all of those words mean, but we are going to find out together. And the thing that I love about Mike especially is that he's the person who first introduced me to the practice of sharing our spiritual autobiography, something that all of us have now done together as well. He's a wonderful teacher and friend, and I'm so, so thrilled that we get to speak today. So welcome, Mike, to The Nearness.
Thanks for having me.
I'm so excited about this conversation because I feel like as you were sharing your notes for the kind of the places that we might go with this conversation, there's so much depth and richness and history. So let's kind of set the table for our shared meal over the next hour or so, because the reason why I wanted to talk to you was that we're exploring a visualization practice together in the coming weeks in The Nearness. And so as we familiarize ourselves with visualizing and especially visualizing the divine, I want to get a sense of how we can do that safely with a smart approach and also really learning from history. So many people have had incredible sacred visions and seen incredible things that's really shaped how they think about their spirituality. There's so much beauty in that practice, but also a little bit of danger. And so I'm hoping you can help us learn from these wise spiritual practitioners from history. So if you were going to just introduce what visualizing the divine means in your own words, how would you describe it? What's the point of it?
I think the point of it, yeah, what a great question, is to open ourselves up to something that we know that we're not going to know, but that we want to gain some sense of, that Gregory of Nyssa calls it a sense of presence. And it says you kind of have to turn yourself into the kind of person who can receive that or can be open to that, because most of the time in our lives we're not. Like we have a million things in our mind and we're a little bit defensive and a little bit scared, and for good reason. We don't really want to be open to anything all the time. And yet there is some part of us that might be longing to get in touch with that you know, ray of darkness or that kind of sense of the infinite. Call it what you want. And I mean, I think what we're going to talk about is different ways that different people have tried to imagine their way or contemplate their way or kind of blank their way into this sense of the infinite in different ways.
Yeah, that's so true. I mean, we talk about a religion like Christianity, but in fact, we're going to see in this conversation today, there are wildly different approaches, like kind of opposing approaches, even within one tradition. So I want to say up front that even though you're a scholar within that one tradition, there's very, very different ways in which people have visualized the divine within the Christian tradition. So will you introduce us? I feel like we have three characters who are kind of going to guide us through these different approaches. And it's kind of like a casting agency that I'm imagining. Like there's these three kind of like divine imaginers coming up to the modeling desk. Can you introduce us to these three characters?
Yeah, that's perfect. So the three that I think we're going to focus in on, the first one is a fourth century Christian named Evagrius of Pontus. He's a Christian who ends up going and living in the deserts of Egypt. Maybe we can give him a little bit more biography in a second. But the other two are Teresa of Avila and Ignatius of Loyola. And both of them were Christians in the 16th century who were also kind of living through a big change in what Christianity was going to look like. This is in the middle of the Protestant Reformation. And so the 4th century, when Evagrius is living in the 16th century are both these kind of turning point moments in Christianity. The 4th century is kind of in the wake of, if you know something about Constantine, he was the emperor in the beginning of the 4th century, and he converts to Christianity, and he kind of sets off this cascade effect where all of a sudden Christianity goes from being, maybe 10% of the empire to 40, 50, 60%. And Evagrius is trying to imagine, like, okay, what is Christianity going to look like now that it's not like some niche little club, right? Like when it goes from being this kind of subculture to culture, now all of a sudden, you know, what happened to that kind of more intense, smaller, more, even like more accountable kind of Christianity to something that, like, you know, like I want to get this job, so maybe I'm going to start going to church so I can meet some people, and like that's a different kind of thing. And he's got to, like, imagine, like, oh, okay, but, like, you know, what does, like, a authentic spirituality look like here?
So he's trying to discover, as you said, like, what is an authentic expression of spirituality in this moment when religion is kind of being combined with the state, right? Like, empire and religion are being combined. And so he's trying to figure out, well, what does this mean for me? Like, how can I have this sacred connection with the divine while, like, trying to leave behind a little bit the institution, or at least the institution as I know it or as it's become. So I feel like he's super resonant for this moment. And, like, what does he do? Like, how does he try and maintain that? What does it look like for him?
Yeah, so let me give you, like, a little, like, you know, runway into it. Like, he personally, he starts off kind of living what's going to look like a like, normal church career, right? Like, he gets ordained by a kind of big shot named Basil, and he goes with the Bishop of Constantinople to, like, prep for this big conference, and it, like, seems like he's going to be, like, the next kind of protege guy. And then he has an affair with one of the emperor's counselor's wives, and it's, like, it's not good. Like, and some accounts say that it happens, like, in a dream, and some people say, like, this is, like, for real, but, like, the guy, either in a dream or in real life, threatens to kill him, and he's like, I gotta get out of here. And at this time, one of the things that pops up as Christianity is getting, you know, bigger and bigger in the Roman Empire is more and more people start moving into the kind of outlands of Egypt. And he goes. He starts doing, like, philosophy in the desert. We now call it asceticism. Asceticism is just the Greek word for practice. He's trying things. And that involved some fasting, fasting from food, but also from other, you know, worldly pleasures. And he observes how these monks have tried to pursue holiness. And he kind of wanders around, and he interviews them, and he learns what he can from them. But then he kind of, you know, makes it big in the desert when he starts writing these little aphorisms, these little, like, you know, bumper stickers that are meant to guide the souls of those less experienced. He just kind of had a knack for this, right? Like, people loved his teaching because he had a way of summing up really quickly but poignantly just what ailed people, like the kinds of thoughts and rationalizations that would get in their way.
He sounds like someone who'd be really good at writing, like, Instagram content. I'm just imagining, like, a kind of desert tile, you know, selection that you get to slide through with these 8 different, like, self-sabotaging thoughts. I like him already.
Yeah, no, I think he's better on Instagram than Twitter, for what it's worth. Like, he's not a good, like, fight picker, really. He's pithy, and so that makes people think, like, well, yeah, you could put it in 140 characters, but, like, he's like, too introspective. Like, nobody wants that out of your Twitter. Like, but you do want that out of Instagram, right? But he's developing these 8 thoughts, right? And this is the precursor to the 7 deadly sins, but he's not talking about, like, you know, ways that you're going to go to hell. He's talking about these rationales that we use, right? That sometimes we get so angry that anger is kind of the only thing that we can see, or we're so jealous that our jealousy just kind of wraps around everything. And he develops this idea called Akedia, or the noonday demon, like what it's like where you've had lunch and you're just kind of like, it's hot and you're just kind of tired and you just like don't want to do anything. You know, he calls that a demon, but you can see what he means there by demon. It's a kind of mood almost. And he says, what happens when those thoughts, those rationalizations get into us is it makes it hard for us to care about anything. It makes it hard for us to care about ourselves because we're kind of locked out of who we really are, because all we see is the anger or the jealousy or the akedia. But it also makes it hard to see other people for who they really are, and it makes it really hard to see God or the ultimate, right? And he says, you know, the problem is here that once that thought gets inside you, it's really hard to get it out. So his program is really a way to interrupt or to take detours from those normal pathways that our mind goes down.
So for him, the practice of visualization a way of kind of interrupting those negative spirals that we get stuck in terms of our own thinking? Okay, that's super interesting.
Yeah, exactly. And so that's where these little mantras or these little aphorisms come in. So he writes a whole book. There's like 200 pages of different scenarios where one of these eight thoughts is going to kind of grab hold of you. And the book is called Talking Back. And it's about what happens when you can kind of feel that tug on you, when you start to go down that path. And, you know, here's a little line that you can use. It's usually a Bible verse. So that when you feel your mind drifting towards that thought, that rationalization, you can kind of put a check on it, and you can chant this passage, this little aphorism that will help you kind of stop and say, wait, that's not really who I am. That's the anger talking. That's the jealousy talking. That's the akedia talking. And you say, like, okay, I'm back. Who am I really? Who is this person really? Who is God really?
So, Mike, so far I'm getting this idea that Evagrius is like a really good psychologist, or like a therapist, honestly, like someone who's identifying negative patterns of thought, how that relates to your behavior and how to interrupt those kind of cycles. But where is the visualization? Like, what is he telling his students to imagine, especially about the divine?
Yeah, that's great. So his big idea, right, is about this calm or this kind of repose, this deep breath of the soul. Part of that deep breath of the soul is what he calls imageless prayer. And I know that, like, on a podcast about visualization, imageless prayer is about the most annoying thing that somebody could hope for. But what he's going for there is a kind of clearing of the mind. And he says that's actually really hard to do. Like, I'm guessing that many of your listeners have tried to, like, sit and meditate and think of nothing, and there's nothing harder than thinking of nothing, right? And he says that the way to do this is, one, you've got to stop those rationalizations, right? And that's where all these little aphorisms come in. But he's then going to try to build up this tension between the goal of imageless prayer and a life of a monk, where you kind of spend a lot of your time thinking about biblical images. And he says what happens here is you kind of got to start somewhere. One of the examples that he gives is with Moses going up Mount Sinai. And in the book of Exodus, it talks about Moses going to the place of God. And Evagrius says, okay, let's start there. Okay, what is this story really about? Like, what do we mean by the place of God? And then he's going to say something like, you know, what would it mean to say that your cell, the place where you live, your little cabin, is that place? And from there, he says that you move from the physical image to the simple thought. And then he says you sit with that for long enough, and if you're lucky, the blue sapphire of the mind breaks through. That's his image, that you sit and you sit and you sit, and eventually this kind of blue glow takes over. And that doesn't happen all the time, right? But it can happen sometimes. And he says the goal is to kind of sit with enough stillness that eventually that blue sapphire of the mind takes over.
So it sounds like he's kind of illustrating a sort of step-by-step process that you start with a very concrete image. And for him, he's using the Bible as the kind of source of some of those images, right? The rock, the physical place that's described. And that then in kind of a series of, I don't want to say it's a revelation, or maybe it's like an uncovering or something, that you get to a place that's that pure calm that he's described. But I love this image of the sapphire, because I read a paper that you wrote where you describe Evagrius saying that the place of God is utterly free from representation. So there's no imagery left after all of those layers have been taken away. And yet it retains this blue glow, an impress of heaven that's stamped on the mind. Did he mean that literally? Like when you're visualizing God, are you left with like a sort of a blue vision?
You know, he wrote it a long time ago. It's hard to know, but it's hard to say totally no to that, right? I mean, you can imagine him in the desert, you know, without eating a whole lot of food, and he's praying, and there's something kind of ecstatic that takes over, and he's looking up at that big blue sky, and yeah, it seems like something like leaves an impress on his mind that he will never quite forget. And, you know, that the kind of clearing that it takes to get to the place that you're open enough to have that blue sapphire take over takes a long time, and it requires you to be a different kind of person. And yet, you know, it's a really powerful, beautiful image of the blue sapphire.
I mean, I'm also thinking about how I had this incredible trip a few months ago where I was visiting this cave, and we went deep into the cave. This was in Belize, which I was lucky enough to visit. And there were these, I mean, it was a former ritual sacrifice site. So kind of an intense place to be in, you know, going back hundreds of years. And the guide was teaching us about the ways in which color was associated with different levels of consciousness. And in this particular civilization, purple had this particular meaning of the world of the beyond, this kind of transcendent reality. And he invited us to all to kind of extinguish our headlamps. And so we're in this complete darkness, deep in a cave, and it's kind of scary and very like mystical. And he asked us to close our eyes and say out loud what it was that we saw. And I just remember all of us, you know, first you have that kind of echo of the light that you've just turned out. So there's like kind of sparkles. But after about 30 seconds or so, there was this kind of purpley blue haze that we all saw with our eyes closed. And I don't want to equate that with what Evagrius is talking about here about this blue sapphire, but it makes sense to me that in the complete absence of all light and all image, there's still something that remains. And so that's a really beautiful thing to sit with, I think, as we're thinking about visualization, is like, if you can, and my goodness, in, you know, 8 weeks, are we going to get to a sort of monk level of, you know, mystery awareness? I don't know. But if we take a step towards removing some of the images, you know, in the vision, and there is this sort of faint glow that remains, there's an echo there of what he's teaching us, which I think is really cool.
Yeah, that's beautiful. And it seems, you know, very much on point with what he's getting at, that there is this, I love that echo. The other thing about the sapphire, right, is that with a jewel, you almost can't not see a reflection. You're seeing something out there, you're seeing something different, you're seeing something kind of beautiful and mysterious and beyond, but you're also kind of catching glimpses of yourself in that jewel, and you're seeing yourself kind of in light of that jewel as well.
I want to make sure that we have some time for our other mystical teachers, but let me ask one final question about Evagrius, which is that, you know, for a lot of people who were exploring their spirituality in the nearness, you know, for some people, the Bible might still be a place that feels like an entry point into starting with that place where God is. But for a lot of people who were never Christian in the first place or who've really struggled within that tradition, it might not be. Do you think Evagrius, I'm now asking you to channel him and like share his wisdom in 2023, but do you think he would say, no, you have to start with a biblical image, or do you have to start with an image like God's place? And so if for you, like whatever that might mean, I don't know, maybe it's a really beautiful place that you've been to, or maybe it's a maybe even a person. Like I'm just wondering how wide the aperture is of like using Evagrius's kind of steps for someone for whom the Bible isn't going to be an entry point that feels accessible.
I mean, like, what would Evagrius say? Like, Evagrius would say, like, absolutely not. Like, you're a heretic and you're going to hell. That's not true. Like, so Evagrius, sorry, Evagrius would not say you're going to hell, because Evagrius gets like excommunicated or gets condemned as a heretic because he didn't think anybody was going to hell. But that's a different issue. I do think that, like, Evagrius thinks that there's something important about starting with scripture, in part because he thinks it's like an important disciplining device, right? To say like, no, man, you can't just like pick your favorite book. Not because your favorite book it like sucks or anything, but because like we're trying to constrain ourselves in a certain way. And so we want to be really intentional about what kinds of boundaries we draw as a community that will make it safe to go to this kind of transcendent place, right? That you're really like playing with fire for Evagrius, right? That he is very well aware that he is talking about getting to a place where the rules and regulations that even churches provide like won't hold anymore. And yet, like, to create people who are capable of that, he thinks like you gotta like keep the boundaries pretty tight. And so in some ways I gave you like the beautiful Evagrius, whereas like there's also the like, I'm gonna count how many grains of rice you're eating every day, Evagrius, right? And he would say yes to both those things. I think the other answer to that, though, is, you know, maybe Evagrius doesn't think that you should use anything outside of the Bible, but I think his method, like, can and often does work for other people. And I think the trick there is that you need to have a community that will hold you accountable with whatever it is that you're going to kind of chant yourself back to yourself with, right? That whatever those little aphorisms are that are going to bring you back to yourself, like, you want them to be able to hold.
Yeah, that's really helpful. And it's one of the reasons why we wanted to explore this practice in small groups, because then you have the chance to share what's happening, what you're noticing, and maybe, you know, whether it's one of those aphorisms or whether it's simply the kind of the I don't want to say the results, but the stories of the experience, to share that with other people and have people who wish you well and want the best for you to help us all stay, just within the realms of what's healthy for us. So I'm glad that he's on the community train with us. But let's appreciate Evagrius and say thank you for that blue sapphire of heaven, and explore some of these other mystics who we're now kind of time traveling, you know, hundreds of years into the future. We're now into the kind of early modern period of European history, where Teresa of Avila, who's famous for her book The Interior Castle, she's also teaching a community of religious adherents. She's obviously a woman navigating a position of power in a period when, you know, there's not a lot of space for women to be in public forms of leadership. How does she think about this question of visualization? How does it fit into her spiritual life and the life of her community?
Teresa and lots of other people around this time are insisting that, like, you know what? Sometimes images, like, don't need to be cleared. Like, sometimes images really can lead us to what is most transcendent, and that what we need to do is not get rid of those images, but kind of stick with them and play them out even longer. The Interior Castle is a manual on prayer that she is writing after having done the kind of hard, we would call it now, like, organizing work, right? The hard work of actually, like, building community. And she, when she's young, she kind of advances really quickly in the life of prayer, and she kind of becomes famous for having these visions, and she's giving people advice all the time. And then she, like, actually has to do the work of, like, talking with other people and seeing the little, like, petty things that come up in community. And it's frustrating and annoying at times. But it's also, I think she would say, and she does say, where you really see grace happening. That there's something, like, beautiful and wonderful about those big visions, but the hard work of building communities of people show you what grace is really like, show you what work is really like. And so when she writes The Interior Castle, she's kind of, she's seen what prayer actually looks like, and she knows that it's not, you know, always ecstatic all the time, that those glimpses of the blue sapphire of heaven come kind of rarely. But she's asked to write this manual on prayer. How do you pray? And she, like many women at the time, kind of writes in this overly apologetic manner, kind of to get around censors and whatnot. She's a big shot in her day, and she's writing a book that I think she knows is, like, pretty good. And yet, she's always like, well, you know, there's probably some real theologian who could say this more eloquently than I could. But, you know, I'm a woman, and women tend to hear other women better. So, you know, I thought I would just, like, write down what I think, and surely we'll find somebody better. And she says that as she was thinking about how to give some instruction and how to pray, she receives this vision that we consider our soul to be like a castle made entirely out of diamond or very clear crystal in which there are many rooms.
I'm so struck that we have our second, like, jewel image here. Just that sense of, like, we had sapphires, we've got diamonds. And also because from what I remember of my studies of Teresa, there again, there's this sense of developmental stages or kind of steps on the journey, and you go deeper and deeper. And as she imagines this castle, there are, like, chambers within chambers within chambers. And in each step, like, there's this new experience or this new both beauty and also danger, right? Because she writes about the threats that can happen to what you are seeing. Can you talk us a little bit through what some of those dangers are for Teresa?
Yeah, so very much like with Evagrius, Teresa is well aware of the fact that when you spend a lot of time looking for self-knowledge, the dangers of narcissism just grow even more. And that there's, like, a very, very fine line between knowing yourself and be obsessed with yourself, right? That, you know, this is what happens. Like, when you try to put together a community of people who want to know themselves, it can often turn into groups of people who get obsessed with their own spiritual life. When you spend a lot of time thinking about yourself and trying to explore what she calls the many rooms of your soul, that you might get stuck in one of them. You might kind of just, like, dwell in one of them for so long that you miss the fact that for her, one, we don't know ourselves or who we are. That is, like, the key starting point for her. And it's the key starting point for her because at the center of who you are, at the center of your soul, is not you, but God. That might be a tricky thing for people in your community, but just the idea that at the center of you is not some, like, core perfect essence of you-ness, but something beyond you that you will never quite understand, that radiates out and fills every other room, is really important for her practice. And it's what she says, like, really tries to keep her humble. You know, she says that in the center is this main dwelling place where the very secret exchanges between God and the soul takes place. So there's this interplay between, yes, you are important and beloved and matter, and you're talking with something that is both bigger than you and closer to you than you are to yourself. And trusting in that requires this huge amount of both humility and confidence that most people won't actually achieve, right? That most people actually, she says, never enter that castle. But entering the castle, like going inside the soul, is what prayer and reflection are really all about. She says that the kind of goal in this process of introspection is that you become like a little bee who flies all over the soul and takes little bits of honey from each room, and like even flies outside and gets honey like from other people, and then brings it back into the center of who you are. And again, kind of like with Evagris, that this is something you really can't do on your own, that you kind of need the pollen from other people to make the honey within you.
Mike, that's so beautiful. I feel myself like I have tears in my eyes. Just that, I think that wisdom of like what's at the center of who we are. When there's someone I really admire and really respect, it's both that, yes, they are really who they are, but it's like there's something sparkling at the center of who they are that is beyond them. You know, like that's that sense of presence that you can just, I don't know, you can feel it when you're around someone like that. And so the way that she articulates that, and then this bee image, that it's not, you know, that it has to be relational, that it's connected to community, that it feels true. I feel like Teresa's talking about something that I recognize and like just understand intuitively about what it means to be a human person. And so I really appreciate you explaining that this comes from like a life lived in community and like seeing the little fights and the forgivenesses and the, you know, I know that, you know, I think her mother died when she was very young. Like she's lived life, right? Like there's grief, there's grit. It's not just like mystical abstractions. It's this very real, embodied, experienced wisdom.
Yeah. I mean, she lived through a lot. I mean, she almost died as a young woman, and when she was having those kind of mystical experiences as a young woman, she was like on a deathbed for 3 months, and people didn't think that she was going to make it. And I think she learned from that both the power of these kind of flickering moments of intensity, that sometimes they come from God and sometimes they really don't. Like sometimes they are your own imagination or your own kind of self-indulgence, and you really, really want to have a mystical experience, and so you just kind of make one up. Or, you know, she'll say like sometimes it comes from God and sometimes it comes from the devil. Like sometimes those are like the worst parts of you that are flickering up, and you're kind of indulging that because the intensity of it is like too good to pass up. And so she's aware of the dangers of that.
So as we follow Teresa's kind of image of these chambers within the interior castle, can you talk about what happens to us as we move through those visions or through those stages?
Yeah, I think it's worth bringing out two aspects of this. So she describes this kind of 7-room journey, and she'll say there's lots more than 7 rooms, but if you understand kind of how this progression works, then you're going to be able to move through the many more rooms of your soul. But the journey more or less breaks down into this first part where she gives the example of a garden, and she says in the first part you're kind of tending to and watering your garden, and she calls this a kind of imaginative phase where you are saying the right prayers, you're living the right kind of life, you are trying to imagine the right stories, you're kind of working on yourself in that way. And then as you progress, your soul kind of expands, and you want to love more, you want to love your neighbors more, you want to love God more, and it leads you from imagination into what she calls contemplation. Here you kind of step back and try to allow God to give you those images. And so you go from kind of tending your garden to hoping something grows. When those visions come, there's kind of 2 checks that we should have on them in order to see, you know, is this really coming from God? The first one is does it inspire a kind of, she calls it confusion, but what she I think means by that is kind of an awe. Is it kind of endlessly explorable, that vision that you get? So kind of like her castle, right? That you can just kind of keep moving through that castle over and over and over again, and you're never going to run out of rooms. And the second thing is, does it inspire humility? And she says, those visions that don't come from God or that don't come from the kind of the best of us are the ones that make us really sure of ourselves and the ones that make us kind of fundamentalist about it, right? That there's one way to say this, there's one way to see this, there's one way to be here. And it makes us kind of proud. It makes us feel like we've got to tell other people what to do all the time. And she says, if that's the vision that you have, it might not be from God. The vision that inspires kind of confusion, that you don't quite know what you saw, you don't quite know what to do with it, but you're sure of it, and it might be the most real thing you've ever seen, and yet you can't quite put it into words, and it was momentary and fleeting, and yet it makes you love your neighbor more, and it makes you a little bit more humble and a little bit more confident, because that's when you know that something has come from God.
That right there is fire, right? Because I think so many people have had that experience of like being, I mean, and it can come in all sorts of places, right? Often people talk about nature or like holding a newborn member of their family, just like this overwhelm of like it's both clarity and confusion. It's like, I know that this is real, but what on earth do I do with it? How do I even talk about it? It's destabilizing in its certainty, and yet so confusing too, because it's like, how what do I do with this? I mean, even right as I'm talking about it, I'm struggling. So I love that she points us to that there's this sense of this clarity that it should make us more humble, more loving, more generous, more forgiving. Like it just pulls us towards that. You know, our spiritual lives is about how do we respond to that call. Evagrius really started with this kind of sense of taking away images and trying to get to this sort of emptiness or clearness. And we're left with that beautiful sapphire of heaven. But I'm also hearing in what you said about that move from visualization or you know, to contemplation, that actually for Teresa, even though we're starting with these images, there's also a sort of place of receptivity or where we're not trying to create images, but we are receiving. It feels like there's a, not necessarily an emptiness, but a sort of spaciousness in that place that she's taking us to as well. So there's kind of more overlap than I thought at first, which is cool. Let's turn to our third kind of historic figure in this question of visualization. And we're going to stay in Spain, and we're going to stay in the 16th century as we turn to Ignatius of Loyola. He's this soldier who gets wounded, and he's confronted by his own mortality and as he's in bed and with his cannonball stuck in his leg. I may be making that bit up, but, you know, he's definitely in a similar way to Teresa, is really confronted with his own mortality and starts to find a sort of, really a sort of strategy for visualization that, again, is very social in the way that he teaches it. He has all sorts of students coming to him. He founded the Jesuit order. I mean, he's a real serious player kind of within the history of the Catholic Church specifically. But can you talk to us about what's his approach to visualization? How does it differ from what Teresa and Evagrius have been teaching us so far?
With Ignatius, one of the kind of big tools that he has is what he calls sacred imagination. So, you know, for him, these are usually biblical stories or stories of the saints. You let yourself imagine your way into a scene. And you do that because sometimes these stories have become so familiar that you just assume that you know, like, okay, here's the story, here's the point. But that when you actually have to put yourself into the story, so one of the stories might be, you're on a boat, and there's a big storm, and Jesus is asleep. And, like, what are you thinking? Like, why is Jesus asleep? What is going on? How does that make you feel? What do you notice? What Ignatius is getting at there is you are probably, I mean, you're almost guaranteed to project your own emotions, your own ideas, your own hopes, your own aspirations onto this story. And then you can talk about it with some other people and say, okay, what did I notice? Why did I feel like that? And did you feel like that too? And so these stories become a kind of mirror that you can hold up to yourself and say, do I want to look like that? How do I want to react in a situation like this? What kind of person would I have to be to react the way I want to react in a situation like this?
There's this whole like 30-day journey that he designs to do this. It feels so accessible. I mean, not in a foolhardy way, but especially if you're starting with a story that you already know, it's really about like experiencing it in a deeper, richer way. You know, if I'm on the boat, can I taste the saltiness in the air? Can I feel the rocking? Can I see who else is, you know, in the story? Where are they sitting? What's happening? What do I feel? What it just makes it more alive. And I think this feels like a really good entry point to do that with a story. You know, I'm going to claim some authorship here from Ignatius. We won't put this on him. But whether it's a biblical story or not, you know, if there's a story that has that deep meaning, I feel like this is one way in which we get to practice that muscle of visualizing with, you know, Teresa's great wisdom of like, does it lead you to awe and humility? And, you know, if you get to the blue sapphire of heaven, extra bonus points to you. But that feels like I'm leaving this conversation with a sense of like what the first couple of steps are as we practice this. And I'm really curious, Mike, I mean, you're a scholar, but you're also a dad. You're also a man of a deep and broad faith. Like how have these practices, if at all, been part of your own life? Like, does it feel disconnected from your own spirituality or are they really mutually informing one another?
I think that they're pretty mutually informing. I mean, I remember the first time I was introduced to this sacred imagination. I was, I think, a freshman in high school. I mean, I just totally remember, like, we were asked to imagine ourselves on a boat with Jesus. And it just, I had never, I don't know, I really was going to church because there was a girl that I had a crush on. And something just kind of slowly clicked where it was like, right, this is something that you have to live and to imagine, and you can kind of feel your way into this. And whether I'm teaching or preaching or as you kind of really put your finger on, right, getting yourself to notice, what is it that I find sacred in this story? Like, what is the thing that is kind of popping for me right now? And then what does it look like to stick with that for a little while?
Well, thank you for helping us stick with these incredible characters from history, these spiritual teachers. And Mike, just a huge thank you for your insight and your expertise. It's so exciting to learn from you. You're a wonderful teacher. And I'm really leaving this conversation with this image of the bee just buzzing between these diamond rooms, you know, within myself, but between all of us, and just that sacred honey that comes from practices like this. So thank you for being here and sharing what you know. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. It's a real delight to talk with you and to get to explore this with you.